Hey folks, it's John. Welcome back to Everything That Rises, a podcast that's normally about the short stories of the one and only Miss Flannery O'Connor. My name is John Meehan, and I'm an English teacher, a writer, author, presenter, podcaster. And typically what we would do is every week we would have a conversation about one of the short stories of Flannery O'Connor. We try to break it into 2 weeks for each episode. But today will be a very special episode. I haven't had a chance in wake of all of the stuff that's going on with these race-related protests, these deeper conversations about these hidden secrets and these awful things in American history that are now coming to light through the death of George Floyd. This is a very special episode, and you can feel free, if it doesn't fit your typical listening pleasures, to, you know, listen to another one instead. But I think it was really powerful and really timely. So I had the chance to catch up with an educator friend of mine. Her name is Sloane Joseph, and you'll hear today's podcast. We talk not about a short story of Flannery O'Connor, but the short story called Sweet Potato Pie, which is actually by an American author still alive. Her name is Eugenia Collier. You may know her from her short story, Marigolds. Though Collier and O'Connor are not the same author, and they are not the same person in any form or fashion, they are contemporaries of one another, and both are women in the South, and both write extensively about issues of race and acceptance and awareness. And there's been some great articles recently about Flannery O'Connor, who she is, how she feels about very controversial issues about race. There was a good article in The New Yorker last week about that. So today it will be a very special episode, and it's a different episode, and I hope that's all right. But we'll be diving into a short study of Flannery O'Connor through the lens not of Flannery O'Connor, rather through the lens of this awesome piece called Sweet Potato Pie, by the one and only Eugenia Collier. I want to say thanks again for tuning in. If you like our podcast, feel free to like or subscribe. Message me. We might do these special episodes every now and again as they come up. Sometimes I think it's really important to broaden our understanding. So this is not something we'll do all the time, but to supplement and to kind of enhance our enriched study of fiction and the American canon, Southern literature, women's literature, and faith-based literature. Flannery O'Connor is amazing. I think she's a shining example of some of the best of it. But as we inform our conversations about these things in light of, you know, contemporary issues, I think this is important too. So I hope that's okay. Thanks. Enjoy the show. And I'll duck out, and I'll see you again next time. Thanks. Hi, everybody. I'm John Meehan, and I wanted to welcome you to a special episode of our podcast today. I've invited somebody who I met at a conference, and they're an educator based out of North Carolina, but I'm not going to introduce her. I'm going to let her introduce herself. My esteemed guest, do you want to introduce yourself and say hey?
Hi, my name is Sloane Joseph, and I'm out of Greenville, South Carolina. I'm a middle school instructional technology coach with a little over 17 years of experience in K-4 through 12th grade, and I am extremely excited about being able to share with you today.
Hey, thanks so much. I also want to point out that I said North Carolina, and you're from South Carolina. Now already we're like not friends, because that's a big difference, isn't it?
That is a big difference to us, but there is a Greenville, North Carolina, so I'm going to let you get away with that.
All right, thank God. Yeah, that's my reason. Not that anything south of the Mason-Dixon line to me is all the same, because I'm going to own my biases. Like, I'm from New Jersey, so when I drive south of, like, Pennsylvania, it may as well all be Kentucky or Kansas. I don't know the difference between any of that
stuff. All run together, huh?
But yeah, exactly right. But you in the Carolinas, you've seen school both from the classroom side and the administrative side. Because before we get into today's story, like in my own school, I work as a classroom teacher, but I also work with teachers in like teacher training and teacher coaching. Okay. Can you give our listeners a bit of a insight on to who you are and kind of how that fits in for you?
Well, I started I'm a career changer. So I didn't go to school to be an educator. I went to school for business administration, human resources, and finances are the areas that I worked in. And so this is my second career. And I have done, so as a business administration major, it just made sense for me to go into business education. So what I was certified in is computer technology, marketing, and business classes. So I would teach anything from small business entrepreneurship, travel and tourism, computer tech, just lots of different things that students, you know, really were interested in as their elective classes, because I was preparing them for what seemed, you know, obtainable to them within their years of graduating. But I also wanted to kind of diversify what I was doing, because I saw such a need in high school, and I was really interested in how do they get to this point where maybe they're in high school and they're not reading on grade level, or
right,
they are reading on grade level, but they don't know how to balance a checkbook, or at that time a checkbook, or they don't know how to, you know, create a bank
account, or
absolutely. And you've got kids in high school, they're working, and I want to help them be able to manage their money. And so one of my mentors at the time, Dr. Marvin York, he was like, I think you'd be great if you went and did middle school. So I have done middle school before. I've done as a teacher and high school as a teacher. But as an administrator, I've done K-4 all the way through 12th grade. And I think that helps me, because right now I'm in a middle school. So what I'm able to bring to the table is that I know where my students have been, but I know where my students are going. And so me trying to help, not just academically, but social and emotionally, where are they coming from? Where do they need to go? And so I've used technology, business, marketing, those classes to open doors for me to be able to be an instructional technology coach, which means in business classes, you have to be able to write an email. So that's English. You have to know math if you're going to balance a budget. And so I can find ways in my business, my computer technology class, to connect with any other subject. I can easily do that. And so it makes my class relevant to those students that are taking my class. But my passion really is just teaching kids to have empathy for one another, to listen, to be able to listen to one another's stories, and to be able to learn and share with one another. I'm really big on students being able to work in groups. I'm really big on teaching students how to agree and disagree in a respectful manner, in an appropriate way, so that there can actually be some type of actionable change once the conversation is over and people have learned a little bit more about each other's experiences. And that can't happen in a lecture type series. That has to be where teachers release the reins and allow students to collaborate and work together and then share what they've learned. But also teaching them how to do that in a respectful way.
I completely agree. And I think, so that leads us actually in today's story. We're talking about Eugenia Collier's short story, Sweet Potato Pie. If you haven't had a chance to see it, I'll put it in the show notes for anybody who wants to give a read. It's a quick read, maybe 15, 20 minutes. And we're going to go deep into it. But a bit about my own awareness. So you can probably hear from my white guy voice, like I'm a white boy from New Jersey. I was a career changer myself.
No kidding.
So yeah, I was working in media and marketing. I was event planning for about 5 years, social media. And then I made the switch to the economy hit the skids in like 2010, and I made a move because I knew I wanted to write, and I thought, oh man, well maybe if I just switch to teaching, I could get my summers off because teachers don't do any work in the summer.
I'm doing nothing right now.
No, not at all. And so I made this jump to this teaching gig, thinking it would give me more time to write. But the teaching program I went through was the New Teacher Project, which put me in free and reduced meals achievement gap schools in the greater Washington, D.C. area. So even though I grew up as a public school kid from Jersey, who like, I mean, we're talking the top 10 public school systems in the country. Like, you know, I was very blessed in that, even though my own experience was not someone who came from wealth. I certainly had these invisible privileges that I was unaware of. And because I came through TNTP, they had us become aware of where we were going into, like, you know, deep inside achievement gap high schools. And they're like, you probably should start by doing this thing called the Harvard Implicit Bias Test and this thing called Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack of White Privilege. I'm like, come on. Like, I'm not racist. I'm not part of the Klan. And they're like, no. I'm not saying you're part of the Klan. What we're saying is, and Jane Elliott, who wrote the book, The Blue Eyes, Brown Eyes Experiment.
Love her.
She says, oh my gosh, she's great. I just picked up a copy of her book called The Color in My Pocket, which is about like the science behind or the research behind why she did the research she did.
Okay.
But she said, if you've graduated from the United States public school system and you are not a racist, then you are a miracle. I was like, whoa,
wow.
That hurts. And there's a white lady, right? Like an old white lady who's still alive.
Yeah.
And I think that for me was very eye-opening, because if I am, you know, before there was a word for it, quote, woke white kid, you know, like, oh, I believe in social justice and advocacy. I do mission trip. I do, you know, like service opportunities. I give food to the poor. I, you know,
right.
Things in other countries. I build houses for Habitat for Humanity. Aren't I, you know, a good little Christian boy? It's like, no, that's not it. And in fact, so much of that is rooted in this idea of this white saviorism and this one-dimensional idea of, and to get to today's story. So we're going to talk about sweet potato pie. But when I was in my first school teaching assignment, like the first book I had to teach was To Kill a Mockingbird. And I laughed because I was like, this feels like a product of white guilt that was informing how to teach black kids about racism. Yeah. We're going to have a story. And like, I love To Kill a Mockingbird. I just bought a copy of it again yesterday because I think it's an amazing book that's very powerful. But it makes racism palatable to white folks through the lens of, let's have a white character who's doing the work versus the centering on this own voices. And that's why the story from Collier really, really struck me and stayed with me 10 years ago when I first taught it. And so I pushed it out on Twitter. I was like, hey, anybody who's interested in doing some of this work, maybe this is something to look at. And you responded. You're like, oh, definitely take a look at that. And I'm interested here because before we went on air, we were starting to get excited about the story and you used the word phenomenal. And I'm like, oh, dang it, I want this all captured on recording. So I'm just going to shut up and let you talk for a little bit about like your initial impressions, like how we came to the story, and then we can get into some, you know, nitty gritty from there.
Well, I just saw it, and that's what I love about Twitter is I probably would never have come across this story. I've never seen this story before. So I've never read this story before, and I probably would not have ever read it had I not been connected to you on Twitter. And so yeah. I'm all about short stories. Just because of my attention span. Like you said, it's not like a long novel. It's a very powerful short piece. And one of the things that like the level of the characters, this one character that, you know, as we would call it, made it out, but still being very much connected and feeling very responsible and feeling like their success is because of this group of people that's behind them that didn't have it. So it's like that survivor's guilt that you get sometimes. I am second generation to go to college, but I definitely come from sharecroppers. And so, you know, it's not so far removed. And so there are some of my family members that have, you know, gone on to college and are able to benefit from that experience, but there are some that have not. And so, but that's still family, and you still feel that obligation to help them out. And they feel that obligation to protect you in some way. And so that this really touched, you know, well, sweet potato pie, just because the title is awesome.
it's so specific to a place and a setting and a time and like a social, like
it's all about it. I talk about how much I have a podcast that I do, and I talk about food all the time. And so that
we should pause here real quick. Hold on, wait, because you mentioned Twitter. So Sloan, real quick. Sloan, you have a podcast and you have a Twitter account. We should mention that because anybody who's listening, like, I don't know whether I'm going to give this to my students, your students, or to the world, but can you just give a quick plug for your projects before we get into this story any closer?
Absolutely. So on Twitter, I'm there at P Sloan Joseph, and that's PSLOAN Joseph, JOSEPH. That's me on Twitter. On Instagram, I'm at GreaterIsInMe _, and that goes along with my podcast, which is GreaterIsInMe, and that's on Spotify, iTunes, Anchor. I'm on Google Podcasts, your just normal platform, so you can kind of search up GreaterIsInMe podcast. And and so it's all about my hashtag is hashtag inform, inspire, influence. And I'm trying to, with each episode or each time that I'm posting something, to inform, inspire, influence listeners or viewers to fulfill the greatness that exists within. That's how that goes. So I do talk about, you know, food a lot on my podcast. And so that's why sweet potato pie kind of drew me in. And then when I started reading the first part, within a page or two, I could identify with that, which, you know, kind of aligns with the interest for reading it. The entire thing was that connection and how I was a student of yours without even knowing that. So in that scenario, when you, give me a piece that I can connect with for whatever the reason, then I'm going to be more interested in it. I'm going to, dive in a little bit deeper. I'm more likely to read it to the end. And so that's just, along with what we're talking about, making sure that, content is relevant. Everything can't be relevant all the time. And I get that. But that's one of the things that kind of drew me in. The title, my connection with food, reading the first page and making some connections with my own life.
Well, I'm interested in that too, because I was a career changer, like I said. This was in the curriculum for that first year. And I remember it being the most powerful single day experience of my first year of teaching. And I was like, this is what I want to do with the rest of my life. Like, I felt like I had belonged because I was in a school. I had 42 kids in a classroom and only desks for 35. So like, it was deep in like some serious achievement gap issues. I'm talking about like free and reduced meals. 87% of my students free and reduced meals. I had students in a classroom, I taught a ninth grade and a 10th grade, and the average reading level between the two classes, like a third and fourth grade reading level. And here I am like trying to get her to care about, Atticus Finch or, anybody else. And then like, I should point out, like, there are good things that you can get to in the novel. And I think you're right that not everything will be appealing to every person at all times, but there's something about the human condition that does resonate in what good literature could do. And I'm a big fan of To Kill a Mockingbird as in its appropriate context. But what struck me about Sweet Potato Pie was I didn't know, I'm going to keep this clean because it's a family friendly podcast. I didn't know zero bupkis about Sweet Potato Pie. Even to hear it, it sounded disgusting to me. I was like, you're making a pie of potatoes? That doesn't compute in my brain. Never have had that in my life. So my warm-up question, because that was the I do, we do, you do approach in the classroom. I had read the story the night before and I was like, okay. I asked the kids, I said, what is soul food? And I just like asked, and then I shut up and I let every kid go with a million different directions. And it was the most energy and excitement and enthusiasm we ever could, because there's something that's very sociable about being able to talk about home traditions and like family traditions and like family values that come through coming together and having a meal together and eating together and sharing together. And like, so I'm not even playing dumb. I literally don't know. I was like, so what you're saying, it's like a home cooked meal. My mom's a great cook. She makes this great Italian food. Is that soul food? And then the students are like, no, because it has to have this. I was like, well, my mom could make those foods too. Like, no, it's not the same, you see. And I started to like, in that moment, realize that as my students are co-creating the classroom with me, it's way more exciting for all of us. Like, versus one of us who is like, no, write this down. Soul food equals A, B, and C. It must have the elements of family and Southern and like, forget it, right? Like that's very didactic, and it's sort of pigeonholing a student's experience into a very narrow space versus, I don't know, just tell me. And if I was to ask you like about sweet potato pie, I'm sure you've had sweet potato pie because you said it resonated with you, but like, I'm sure you have your favorite version of it and who in your family makes it, whether it's an aunt or a grandparent or a mom or like a cousin, like there's one person in your family who has the perfect recipe for that thing. Just like in my mom's side of the family with the Italian stuff, there's the one aunt who I would never have her spaghetti sauce, but I would have the other aunt's spaghetti sauce. Like, it's like a thing.
The sweet potato, you can have like all of these sweet potato pies on a counter, but you come in and you're like, who made
this? You do, right?
Like, I need to know who made this one, because they all look the same, but I know that this one has like this extra something to it, And the thing about what you're saying in that moment, like asking them and opening it up and you being willing to let it go in a million different directions, is we had talked about previously before we started recording, students have to have what me and some of my circle call racially inclusive learning environments. And that means that I know that at some point, you're going to make some connections or ask me to make some connections with some things. But in any classroom environment, whether it's an all white class or all black class or a mix, students have to feel like you as the educator see, hear, value, and respect and appreciate them and their story, their lives outside of your classroom. So once they feel that way, that tears down a piece of a wall that I think we all have when we go into new spaces. So if you're willing to teacher, listen to me, see me, understand my experience, respect my experience, then now I am willing to, when it's time to give you that same time. So when it's time for you
to be seen, heard, valued, and respected, I can do that. So even though you were just talking about sweet potato pie and soul food and what are the components of that, and that's their opinion and all of those things, it really allowed them, you to lay that foundation of, there are going to be times when I'm speaking and you're learning, but I'm here as the teacher to also learn from you, yeah, and to be able to walk away knowing more about you and your experience, just like I want you to be able to walk away and know more about me and my experience. So that conversation and giving them that time, I think is probably something that stays with them, and that they probably talk about right now, that wasn't even the purpose of you doing that, but it was just like, let me just open up this conversation and get it going. But it's so many layers that came out of it.
Well, and it is too, because ultimately what was arrived at was like, I was like, so let me hear you. And like, you know, you play dumb because that's a good teacher trick. So let me hear what you're saying. Is this what you're saying? Then they clarify, they're thinking through 3, 4, mm-hmm. 5 times. But I was like, so what you're saying is it's like Southern style food. So like, and I could list like places like Popeyes, right? I was like, oh, that's like Southern style food. And they're like, no, it has to be made at home. I was like, okay, so Southern style food made at home, and it has to be made by someone in your family or someone in your neighborhood. And like, we eventually get to the point, and there's a race element there too. Like, yes, white people can make these foods that are traditional to Black communities, but there's something about it that's a lived and shared experience that says, but there's something that's undeniably and unapologetically Black about it. And mm-hmm. like, all I can do is like white-splain it and kind of laugh at my own like ignorance to it. I was like, so what you're saying is, even if I can make some really good versions of it, it's not the same. And they're like, yep, that's pretty much it. Like, even right. if my thing objectively tastes a little different or a little better, has the right seasoning, there's that it was made with. And we'll talk about some of the language in the story too, like that your soul is hungry for that food. It's not about the, you know, the appropriate seasoning or the appropriate amount of sugar and salt and things like that, the ingredients per se. It's that there's a almost like a level of nostalgia or like familial, just generational connection there, that when I eat this thing, I'm having the same thing that the people before me have had, and the people before them have had that. And my mom's, you know, side is Italian, my dad's side is Irish Polish. And like, you know, we'll have like these weird traditional foods that we eat only on holidays, and no one really loves them, but like we eat them because it's the holiday. And mm-hmm. that's just because it's what you did. It's what you do. And it would be weird. And on those holidays where someone invariably, you know, as family members age or, you know, pass away or move, it feels lonely that there is not, oh, so-and-so used to make the, you know, the pierogies. It's like a Polish like potato dumpling. It's like, it's just weird that they don't have that person's food anymore. Like, I can still eat that food. I can go to the store to buy it today, but I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't go to a fast food store and be like, oh yeah, I want grandma's version of, because it's not from grandma. So it's never going to be the same thing.
Not the same.
So the story, like, so as a quick summary for those who are maybe reading at home or checking out, students or adult learners, you know, I'm thinking about this in real time. There's so much application for grownups and for kids. Like Sweet Potato Pie tells a story of, a guy who's done well for himself. His name's Buddy. You mentioned he kind of made it out. And his familial relationship with his brother, Charlie, sort of in a large flashback. Sloan, would you feel comfortable, like, kind of giving us, like, as if this was a Netflix TV show, could you give us like maybe like a 30-second episode recap of what the story was about, just to kind of help people kind of find their footing in it?
So Buddy is, I think that's his name, or that's what he's referred to. He's the one that made it out. His brothers, his parents worked a lot. And so his older brothers and sisters basically raised him. And then he has all of these memories of the sacrifices and the love that they, and the discipline that they gave him. And, you know, what they were willing to do in order for him to be able to not have to work in the fields, but to be able to get, you know, what folks would call schooling, and mm-hmm. how that schooling then allowed him to be able to travel away from his small, you know, town, and be able to present at this conference that just made all of them proud, and how he's going to visit his brother, who was one of those that made the sacrifice, and how they just think that he's so awesome. But he's like caught in the middle of both worlds, trying not to feel guilty that he made it out, but also trying to stay connected to the people that made a way for him to be able to make it out.
I think that's a really poignant and very powerful and very precarious. There's three P words, because like there's a guy here, and like you said, we call him Buddy. We don't actually know his name is maybe Buddy. Maybe that's like what his brother calls him, right? You know, but like he might actually be named William, you know, or Joseph. But he goes by Buddy, which is a very familial thing. And he looks back to his very modest, very humble origins as a child of sharecroppers, and says, like, you know, there are moments, two or three moments in the story where like his brother, his older siblings almost get upset with him, not like angry with him, but like, no, man, you're the guy who made it out. Like, you're our guy. You need to sit up. You need to straighten up and fly right. Like, because if you do well, then like all of our sacrifices, all of our hard work was worth it. Like, we see ourselves in you. And that puts a pressure on this, you know, like this very humble, you know, I'm just Buddy. Like, no, you're not. You are the sum total of, like, you know, that line from Moana, the village believes in you, right? Like, everyone came together. And like, if we had to bet on one of us, it's you, man. So you got to do it.
Yeah, even when they were talking,
incredible pressure.
Yeah, even when they were talking about, you know, the graduation section. So they were talking about, it comes to a point where they're talking about graduation and they're fussing over, you know, is his tie straight and his pants and all of these things. It's like, not, you've got to look the part. Like, you know, because of the work that we do, we don't get an opportunity unless we go to church. It talks about church a little bit in there.
Yes.
Unless we're at church, we're not able to dress in this way, either because we can't afford it or it doesn't align with the job that we do. So not only, you know, the way that you speak and what you've done, but the way that you look, it's layers to this. Like, you can't just be smart. You have to look smart. You have to speak in a certain way. And it's that he embodies everything that they want it to be or that they wish that they could have done, but because of the times were not allowed to do. And it seems like he's the youngest. He's their last chance. He's their last chance for this to happen. If this doesn't happen for him, then it just makes it seem like everything was in vain, and there's really no hope for the future being any different, not just for them, but for their children. So him being able to make it gives them hope for their children to be able to make it as well.
So in as much as the, this is really like for anyone who's listening, this is what literary critics do, like literary analysis of things when we look way too deep into stuff, but it's not, because it's all here in the story. Like, Collier's work is great. She's still alive, by the way. I was doing research on her real quick. She's still alive. She's in Maryland where I live. So I feel like maybe I can just drive to her house and hang out one day and be like, hey, can we just talk about short stories? She's like 93. Absolutely. I don't know if she would be interested. Like, in the time of COVID, I just roll up like, hi, this is weird. You don't know me, but I like your stories. But like, as far as literary criticism goes, in as much as soul food connects him to his past, it seems like Buddy becomes a connection to this entire family's future. And he becomes like the symbol of the promise of tomorrow. They say as the years passed, middle of like, it's a four page, very short story and presented in like left and right frames. But on the left hand side, it says, you know, as the years passed, the economic strain was eased enough to make it possible for me to go on to the high school. There were fewer mouths to feed, for one thing. Alberta went north to find work at 16. Jamie died at 12. That is said so matter-of-factly and so dispassionately. We get the sense that it's like he's told the story many times. And even those things, like that Jamie's death was a sacrifice that was made on behalf of this family. Like, in her dying, she allows this to happen. I think about, you know, and again, I when I was teaching with my own students, I would just recognize Irish families, you know, very famously had these big, large things, and talk about our own potato history until this potato famine. It was very sad and very scary to think like, oh, well, Irish people would tend to have a lot of kids, not just because they're Catholic, but because the likelihood of having a kid who would die was pretty high. So you had to, in order to run your own farms, you had to have 3, 4, 5, 8 children. And it was an understanding that the youngest ones would often go on to be priests because there was no money. That was your way out. And for this thing, like, there were the ones who died, the ones who got religion, and the ones who stayed and worked the, you know, like the commitment. And there's a, I don't know, as an older child, then I think about my own role in my family, and maybe you can talk about this too, Sloan. Like, there's an expectation that the older kids are kind of the surrogate parents who kind of have to pave the way for younger brothers and sisters. Is that accurate or fair?
I think so. I mean, my older sister, so I'm a middle child. She definitely, you know, your parents don't have a manual. And so it's harder for them because the parents are trying to figure out what's the right way or the wrong way to, you know, to raise children. And so that's the practice child. And then on top of that, while they're working out, like figuring this thing out, because you can have as many books as you want, but until that child is sitting in front of you, like you don't know what to do. But then also, then it becomes easier with the second child and the third child because you've made those mistakes. You kind of figure out, you know, okay, this doesn't work, or this is probably not the best approach, or this is the best approach. And then you had the older child who's also the first to do everything. So my sister was the first to go to college. So that set the tone for us. She was the first one to interview for jobs. She was the first one to get a job. She was the first one to buy a house. And so now it's this ongoing, like she's the person that sets the tone. So she, her life is still teaching us. So like, for instance, yeah, when she started interviewing or when she bought her first house, she was able then to tell me and my younger sister the things that we needed to do to prepare to buy a house. So it just doesn't stop with that, at that childlike, at the childhood phase, it continues on and on. And she very much now, my older sister is very much now that go-to parent. I mean, the go-to person for me and my sister on various things, whether it's career, whether it's marriage, whether it's rearing our own children, because she is doing all of those things first. And that's not what she's asked for. She's just the oldest child. So that's some pressure within itself.
For sure it is. And I think that idea about the pressure, you know, at this crux moment of switching from childhood to adulthood, and like anyone who's listening, and I realize you should always know your audience before you present. Like, I typically take these podcasts and I record them and I share them with my high school students as a chance to hear how like adults talk about these fake stories, which are not fake stories. We read fake stories to learn real truths about the human condition, about empathy, about social justice, about awareness. But as you, in the first two pages, are kind of making your way through the surrogate childhood of our main character, Buddy, you're kind of seeing yourself either as that younger brother or sister who's got those older brothers and sisters looking out for you, or you're seeing yourself maybe in the shoes of those older brothers and sisters, the Charlies of the world, who are trying to pave the road and make those sacrifices, where I'm sure we can all think of a million things we've done, like to make sure our younger brothers and sisters are okay or looked out for, or at least I would hope that our olders to youngers are that. But I'm fascinated, and I want to talk about this graduation sequence here, because he says he finished high school at the head of his class, and you know, everyone in town gives him a little bit of money, just a little bit of money, so he can put it on his, as they say, his graduation clothes. Like literally the word graduation has never even crossed into their frame of reference, because they've never seen someone who's gone to college. And he says, and his graduation.
I'm going to interrupt you right quick.
It's please called graduation. Please do. Always interrupt me. Yeah.
Graduation. So that's
graduation.
Graduation. So the language barrier that's there, because it's not our native language, and over time you're learning it, because again, you're not supposed to, you know, historically you weren't able to read. And if you knew how to read and pronounce these words correctly, then you could be killed. And so then you start to say words in a way that's incorrect to kind of hide what you know, or it's a learned language, but it's not your tribal language. Yeah. So instead of graduation, it comes out as graduation.
Graduation, yeah. And like words, like you said, you know, you said the word keeled, right? Or the word ask or axe. You know, there's a cultural... It's like, I teach American literature, so I use this example a lot. But in Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, there's a moment, a one line, where Jim says to Huck, you know, when you went missing in the beginning, everyone came after looking for me, thinking I had killed you. And he's like, well, you know, well, do you want to tell me the story? And he goes, well, he says, day's reasons, D-E-Y apostrophe S, day's reasons. Like, well, day's reasons, but I would prefer. So again, you see this African-American vernacular. And then he says, well, no, I promise I wouldn't tell. And he goes, well, Huck, I runned off. And he says, run apostrophe D. It's still very rooted in a Southern slave experience. Mm-hmm. But then Huck calls him out on it and says, why, Jim? And then immediately Huck is corrected by Jim, who turns into like perfect super white version of English from Jim, who doesn't have that. He says, but Huck, mind, you said you wouldn't tell. And he says it in perfect, like, because that idea of if you talk too right or if you talk too wrong, you are going to be caught, you are going to be killed, you're going to be like seen as. And in that moment when he has to humanize himself to Huck, he has to code switch and he has to become the whiter version of so that he's seen as an equal, because God forbid he's seen as lesser than in that moment, because it would cost him his freedom. And so there's this learning and this crux of, and we're going to talk about I think W.E.B. Du Bois talks about code switching and the double consciousness, the idea of the Black American experience is simultaneously American and Black. And for this family to see that one of their own who's kind of made it out, made it through the system, is a sign that maybe there's like a loosening of the system, and maybe there's a chance for future generations to get out. And that graduation is a pivotal moment where even to this guy who's in the thick of it, he's like, well, my valedictory address was the usual idealistic, sentimental nonsense. I've forgotten what I said. But like, because to him, it's not a symbol. To him, he's in the thick of it. He doesn't see what the big deal is. But to everyone else in that family, he says it was like a lithograph burned into his memory. He thinks about his mother and he says it as if it was the apex of her life. Like that was very humbling. He says, I realized in that moment that I was not necessarily the smartest, only the youngest and the luckiest.
I was like, oh my goodness, that's awesome. Because he talks about how everybody came together, like his mom, his parents. He even talks about a little bit before what you're talking about, that even Alberta came down from Baltimore. Like that's at that time, we think about that now. Oh, you just jump in a car and you come down. But at that time, that's a big deal. That's a huge big deal. To get the money to come down.
No interstates. No, you're right. Yes. Yes.
You know, the safety issues that come along with, you can't just stay wherever you want to stay if you're on the road, because at this time, you know, Black people were not allowed to just stay in hotels and just to eat at different places and to get gas at different places. So there's a safety issue. This is a huge enough thing to really risk your life and to plan this trip to get there safely and back safely back to Baltimore. But it's worth the risk because it's graduation. And he's the valedictorian, and he's giving this address. And so he looks and he talks about how everybody came back. And which leads me to believe that even when they want everybody to be together, they can't for different reasons. But for this, they made that sacrifice again to be there for him.
Well, and I'm struck by that, too. And I'm interested, and this is, you know, for those who are listening, I don't know whether your racial or your cultural background has similarities with maybe more with mine or different than mine. But in my own tradition, like my mom's family is Italian American, my dad's family is Irish Polish, but my dad's family was not college educated. And so when I was the first person with my dad's last name to make it through college, it was a huge deal. And I went to the Catholic University of America, which is in Washington, D.C. And my family came down to come see it. It was a big deal. You know, all the family members come and do that thing. And whenever you're in a graduation, it doesn't feel like a big deal. Like, who cares? It's just me and my friends. Like, it's hot outside. They read a bunch of names. Like, it's kind of a boring experience. But there is invariably someone who says, it is the tradition of our school that we will withhold all applause till the end of the ceremony. And it's like super fastidious and super rule oriented, because otherwise you'd be there for like 10 hours. But sure enough, like I'm walking across stage, and when I walked across stage, my dad cheered like crazy. Cause like, dude, I paid for this. I sacrificed for this. That's my blood, sweat, and tears that went into that kid. And he's the one who made it out, man. So you know what? I'm gonna be loud. Nobody looked at us like we were anything other than like dopey hillbilly rednecks from Jersey, but like dad couldn't care. He never gonna see those people again. So what? Right? Like,
Exactly. But
now I teach in Washington, D.C. and in the public school system when I worked in Prince George's County, Maryland. And the experience of a graduation in a private school and an experience in a public school south of the Mason-Dixon line is tremendously different. Because where my dad was that one white guy who was shouting and people like, oh, come on, get some class. There is a racial element when we talk about cheering at graduations and the pedagogy of that Pentecostal approach versus the more puritanical like New England. And what we're really saying is the way that Black people celebrate and the way that white people celebrate. Mm-hmm. And this graduation feels like to deny somebody who's risked their life and made those sacrifices the chance to cheer for their own is in some ways it's carceral. It's saying like, no, stay in your lane, stay in your place. You have no right to celebrate in your way. And it forces them to check their cultural Blackness here. I think if that makes sense. And the reason why I'm saying it is because it will play out through the rest of the story. The idea of, to be successful is to be seen as to not be Black. And there's like a buying in or a selling out of culture that seems to come with that here.
Right. And it's very much being caught in the middle sometimes. Like you said, in the whole graduation situation, it's like, on one hand, I understand that you want this to be a very prestigious and very quiet and professional and I don't know whatever other word to use, event. But then when you think about the miles that people have traveled to celebrate this moment, and when I say the miles, it means the years of sacrifice. And, you know, you don't know the story behind that person getting to that point. You don't know the blood, sweat, and tears that have taken place to get them to that point. And, you know, to deny someone the opportunity to affirm, to celebrate someone that has overcome lots of obstacles, it's like, really, you know, and then, you know, when I think about even at high school graduations, for some of our children, they'll never graduate again. People take it for granted that they're going to, you know, for some people going to graduate, going on to go to college and graduate and then get your master's degree and your doctorate degree. That's just what happens. But for a lot of people, those things are up in the air. So let's celebrate now if it never happens again. You know, this is a milestone that we'll never get again. And, you know, I think about like the kids that are graduating from high school 2020. If you're in college, I get it. That's very important.
I get it, right?
A master's degree and a doctor's degree. But I really think about a lot of our children in this country who, if they did not get a chance to have a high school graduation, they may never get that opportunity again. And then to try to stifle their family from celebrating them. And like, you know, with just cheers. And I mean, I feel like, you know, some people in every situation go overboard, but nine times out of 10, people just want about 10 seconds.
They want about 10 seconds
to celebrate 13, 14 years of an experience that this child has had. And it's like, give them that time, give them that time. But we focus on that 10th person, because 9 out of 10 are going to act right. And that one person that goes overboard, we let that person steal the joy for the other 9. And that's what makes me sad.
Well, and I think that, and like, so in this story, they use the word country, like, don't do that. That's country. And like, you can see that. And that's like a very disparaging. When I was in D.C., when I was in post schools, they said that's Bama. And like, that's pretty much a way of saying like, that is the hillbilly version of cultural blackness. Like, nah. But you could be those nine out of ten.
Some people may say that's country, that's hillbilly, that's trashy, that's ghetto. All of those words are meant to demean someone.
Yes.
And so think about that. This person is being celebrated for an achievement, and what we do is we label it something negative.
Yeah.
The direct opposite of that. That's craziness to me.
It is. And that to me is wild, because like, let's just run this to its logical end. Imagine you're in a school with a whole bunch of white folks are now graduating and you let people cheer. Then the ceremony somehow is less important because they put in fewer years of work to get there. No, you just have about 10 seconds longer. And if you have 10 seconds longer for each of 100 kids, okay, well, you know what? We went. I mean, like, but instead of sitting there, like with my butt falling asleep, hearing names mispronounced by people who've never met these children. Now you're like, and every 5 minutes, every 30 seconds, someone's cheering for somebody and happy. Like, how can you not get charged about that? Like, it's crazy. And like, yes, people can go overboard. And like, then it's a game of, can you top this, all that nonsense. But it's a scene where then people are shouting and fighting over each other. I'm not saying that. But like, to those kids who never had that, especially that 2020 thing, I think about like, there was that trend at the start of the lockdown where all the parents or the friends on Facebook were like, oh, I feel bad for the class of 2020. Here's a picture of my senior year. Like, that doesn't help. you're saying, I'm sorry.
Look what I like, did. You might not possibly be able to
do. Oh, man. I'm sorry they canceled your wedding. Here's pictures from my wedding. Does that help? Like, no.
Like, when you give that scenario, that makes so much sense. I know you can't buy a house right now, but here's a picture of my first house. Like, it doesn't make any sense. And then the other thing that, as we, you know, have been talking about a lot of different things over the last couple of weeks, is that centering. It's not that empathy for the other person that's going through the situation. It's like, yeah, you're going through that. Look at me. Look at me.
Oh, yeah.
I can be your inspiration. The way that I do it is the right. You know, it's just like, no. It doesn't always have to come back to you. there are other ways. Dig a little bit deeper where you're not the center of it. Now, how else could you contribute to helping to affirm that child and making that child feel better about their current situation?
So, and I 2 points to it. One, yes, everything you just said is a big yes. I'm thinking that sentiment, you know, like, well, but then I couldn't invite a person who was divorced to my wedding. No, what I'm saying is on the day that they finalize their divorce, don't have that be the day that you deliver the invitation. Like, time and place, read the room, right? I'm not saying that all lives don't matter. What I'm saying is all lives do. And of that subset of lives that matter, today we're talking about these lives that are particularly affected by things like, I'm not saying as a white guy, I've not had a bad day. I'm not prone to depression, anxiety, fear, stress, love, doubt, like heartbreak, sadness, loss. All these things are true. But never once in my life has that been made systemically compounded by the color of my skin. And for that reason, like when we're talking about those graduations, well, all graduations matter. No, moron. If all graduations are not allowed to matter, then no graduations matter. And in this moment, these folks have lost their graduation. So we need to give them that and we need to affirm those things.
Right.
And as we talk about now, and this is a good place maybe to put a pin in a halfway point for our conversation, but like we're talking about the idea of Blackness and cultural Blackness mattering and Black traditions and Black food and Black conversation. And as our next half of our story, we'll pause in a second, takes us to the heart of Harlem and like the heart of ancestral identity of Blackness. It's not my place as a white guy to explain what that means. It's my place as a white guy to shut up and listen and then to allow persons who live that tradition to see it. Because what we'll see then is both Charlie and Buddy identify with cultural Blackness in two very divergent ways. And there is no right or wrong, but that experience is a big tent party that really allows for multiple things. Really can be very humbling and very eye-opening as we talk about how to approach things like race and class and social standing, you know, as an informed society in 2020 going forward.
Absolutely.
So before we put a pause in it, is there anything you would say as like a summary or maybe like a one sentence vibe on where we are so far with this story? Like, hey, if I had to describe my first impressions of the first half of this story or the first, you know, read through, I felt it was ... I find a lot of times for my students, like I'll often ask that kind of question, just, you know, like, hey, how you feeling right now? Let's just check in with you at the first half.
I would just a question. I like to ask people questions so that they can reflect on things. So what sacrifices have been made by this people in this country and people in your family for you to have the comfort that you currently have?
Damn. I'm trying to refrain from cussing, so I will just leave it at that. That's very humbling. And I'm going to shut up and check my privilege, and I'm going to call it a day for now. Sloan, real quick, before we bounce to the second half of this podcast, one more time for anybody who wants to find you on Twitter. I'm on Twitter at @MeehanEDU. Do you want to give your handle one more time?
Yes, I'm on Twitter at P Sloan Joseph. That is PSLOANJOSEPH.
Rock and roll. God bless you. Good for coming back for second half of this podcast?
Absolutely.
All right. We'll come back next time then. Thanks again, guys. More to come. Stay tuned. Thanks.